Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hellett. Well, it has been a week now since deadly tornadoes tore across the region, killing some 36 people, injuring hundreds more. We're going to be talking in depth a little later in the program about what happened on March 2nd. And since then, we begin today's program with our WFPL News Roundtable, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, and Aaron Keene. Welcome back, everyone.
Hey. Hey.
Hello.
As always, we welcome your input. 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Toll free, 1-877-814-TALK. 877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through our Facebook page. And as I mentioned, we're going to be talking in depth with some folks about the storms that hit the area. But we, of course, have been covering them as well. And let's begin on touching on that a little bit before we move on to some other news. Devin, let's start with you. And we'll talk about some logistical matters here. Students from hard-hit Henryville schools will soon resume their studies at temporary sites.
Yeah, it was a little unclear where they were going to be going to school after the storms. This past week, they've obviously been out of class. But the board was considering several different locations, from abandoned factories to, where the high school students are going to be, which is the Mid-America Science Center in Scott County. The elementary school students are going to be at Christian Baptist School, which is in New Albany, and that will begin as soon as they can basically get in there and clear those locations for students to attend class. And that means going over with the fire marshal and health inspectors for different regulations that need to be approved and in place before students can actually be there.
And we don't know exactly when they're going to be going back.
Yeah, it may take a little bit for them to actually get in and clear the sites. There are, I think, about 1,200 students who will be out of class until then. Another big part of that are the logistics behind the transportation. A lot of students were, going on roads that are now closed, and they're not quite sure if the buses are going to be allowed to go through those areas right now, those streets. So they're going to have to kind of reconfigure their routes depending on what's open and what's available.
Erica Peterson, you were among the first from our shop to go to Henryville. On Friday evening, you were up there, did a lot of reporting for us and for NPR, and you got a firsthand look at the school. Devastating.
It was. And Friday night, actually, I didn't get a look at the school because that whole area was just shut off to everyone but emergency personnel. But it's really, it sounds very cliche to say, oh, it's totally gone. It's not. But there's a pile of rubble where most of it used to be. It's a pretty astounding sight.
And you, of course, went back on Sunday, I guess, and got to see some more of the devastation. Erica has put together an audio montage we're going to play at the end of the program of just the people involved, the people helping, and we're going to listen to that a little bit later. Devin has also put together a slide presentation to coincide with that that's on our website, WFPL.org. Let's, again, we're going to be talking more storm damage and tornadoes a little bit later in the program. Let's talk about some other news with our roundtable right now. Philip, you have been following Representative Reginald Meeks, who is running for re-election. He has a unique opponent, I guess you would say, Wendy Caswell, the founder of the Tea Party here in Louisville, running as a Democrat, and now he wants to go to court to challenge her candidacy.
Yeah, State Representative Reginald Meeks here in Louisville, a Democratic lawmaker, he sent a message to Jefferson County Democratic Party leaders about a week ago, asking them to file a lawsuit to have Ms. Caswell removed from the ballot. Representative Meeks' argument is that, the Tea Party basically is a Republican front. He is using some pretty harsh language, saying she's perpetrating a fraud, masquerading as a Democrat, and pointing out some pamphlets and brochures that actually were published and sent from Caswell's home, he claims, saying that they were going to work with GOP operatives, encouraging people in the Tea Party to participate in GOP precinct elections. And Caswell was featured as a speaker along a number of GOP operatives as well. So his argument is that, if we're going to have a Democratic primary, we have to be have integrity to the party. When candidates do file for office, they do sign paperwork saying that they will swear to uphold the policies and principles of their party. I talked to Jefferson County Democratic Party Chairman Bill Ryan, who says that he wants to meet with Caswell just to find out if she really is a Democrat. Now, in previous interviews we did with Ms. Caswell, she said that she is a lifelong Democrat. She's, in fact, a social liberal on a lot of issues. It is a weird thing where she, politically speaking, she's the founder and president of the Louisville Tea Party, yet she's a social liberal in many ways, she claims. But she says, that the Tea Party movement is not about party affiliation. It's more about upholding the U.S. Constitution and common sense in government. So while it's raised a lot of eyebrows her getting into the race, already critics are saying that, you know, you're having a litmus test for her. What about other members of the Democratic Party who may be more conservative than liberal? Are they being asked to meet with party leaders? Are they being asked to file some sort of litmus test to where they have to, you know, they can or can't run, or a potential lawsuit? So the slippery slope of this could be that in many people's minds, at least here in Jefferson County, if you're a member of the Tea Party, can you actually be a Democrat? And according to, you know, Representative Meeks, who laughed at the proposition a few weeks ago, and Chairman Ryan, it's very odd to have someone say they're a member of the Tea Party and be a Democrat running for office.
I guess a lot of people don't know about this this pledge that you sign when you become a candidate. You know, you could. How do you hold somebody to that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question too. I mean, when I asked the Secretary of State's office about it, they said that there is this part of the paperwork where you have to swear to uphold the party's policies and principles. But that gets into the question of here in Kentucky, the Democratic Party is a so-called big tent. So you have someone on one end of the party, like State Representative Jim Gooch, who's very much so against environmental regulations. But then you also have someone like John Yarmuth, who's probably one of the biggest liberals in Congress, who's also a member of that same party. Then, of course, Governor Steve Beshear, who sort of sits in the middle of the road there as a Democrat as well. So there's a question of what can Caswell say to Bill Ryan or say to party leaders to convince them that she actually is a Democrat if she's already been a registered Democrat for a number of years and claims to be a social liberal on issues like abortion and gay marriage.
All right. Thank you, Philip. Devin, let's go back to you. There was a big step this week announced, an announced step, at least, in funding for the Ohio River Bridges Project.
Yeah, and really quickly, I just want to go back to something I mentioned earlier. The new class location for the elementary school for Henryville students will actually be Graceland Christian School. I made a mistake earlier. But yeah, there's a big announcement today. Basically, an agreement, a financial agreement, was signed by both Governor Mitch Daniels and Governor Steve Beshear on how they're going to be paying for this Bridges Project. And the one big thing that we learned with this agreement was the cost of the tolls, or the estimated cost of the tolls. And what that is, what they've laid out, is basically a $1 cost for regular commuters. And there's still, that term is still up for debate for what that means. But essentially, commuters who go across regularly, who have like this transponder device, is what they're calling it, will have basically a $1 toll. All other SUVs or passenger cars will have a $2 toll. And then rates will increase depending on the size of your vehicle. If you're a semi, it can be up to $10. Governor Mitch Daniels says this is a kind of a way to cut the cost for local residents and kind of pay for the Bridges Project on, and what he said is, other people's money. We also saw some interesting things out of this. Well, as we know that both sides, Indiana and Kentucky, have been searching for lead contractors. So that will be happening in the next few weeks. Both sides say by mid-April they would like to have those contractors in place and then start a competitive bidding process and then hopefully have those in place by the fall.
Now, we've had an agreement reached back in December. Indiana builds the East End Bridge. Kentucky oversees the Downtown Bridge and Spaghetti Junction. So do their respective legislatures have to approve this funding plan?
Kentucky is still up for grabs at this point. Governor Steve Beshear has allocated $50 million for the next 2 years in the two-year budget, but that will have to be a larger commitment by the General Assembly. They'll not only have to approve that, but in the plan, it's written that over 6 years, $300 million is approved through the transportation budget for allocation for this fund. So that's definitely something that's going to have to be looked at. Indiana's not so much on the hook. They're using a lot of state money already, and then obviously tolls and their financial plan to go forward with the lead contractor kind of gives them room for the lead contractor to pay for this, and they'll be paid back through certain allocation from the state.
All right. Thank you very much, Devin. Let's go back to you, Erica Peterson. Last night you attended a Public Service Commission public hearing on this proposal by LG&E to convert its Cane Run plant from a coal fire to a natural gas fire.
Yeah. What LG&E wants to do is they want to retire Cane Run as we know it. They aren't going to be removing the building or anything. They're just going to be closing it up, capping off the ash landfills that are currently there, and building some natural gas turbines on the same property right next to it. And as part of that, they're also going to buy some existing gas capacity out in Oldham County. And the thought is that that gas capacity will make up for Cane Run. And they're also retiring two other coal-fired power plants in other parts of the state.
What kind of comments did you hear at the meeting last night?
Well, nobody, predictably, nobody spoke against the plan. As you know, there have been a lot of concerns by people living around Cane Run about pollution from the coal ash, as well as just from living across from a coal-fired power plant and the emissions in the air. So nobody came out and said, you know, PSC, don't approve this. We want to keep coal there. What we really heard were lots of people speaking in favor of the plan, but lots of people saying they wanted it to happen now. They didn't want to wait 4 years, which is the time frame to do it. And there were some people who also thought that natural gas itself has too many problems associated with it, and they'd prefer to see natural gas as a transition from coal to some kind of renewable energy.
Any timetable on a decision from the PSC?
No, there's an evidentiary hearing coming up in about a week, or it's March 20th, I believe, where the PSC will actually hear testimony, and they should be releasing their decision soon after that.
All right. Thanks, Erica. And finally, we're going to turn to Aaron Keene, WFPL's new arts and humanities reporter, who's been very busy with the Humana Festival of New American Plays. Aaron, we talked to you last week. The festival was just getting underway. It's in full swing now. What have you seen?
I've seen two more plays. Mm-hmm. The Hour of Feeling opened this week by Mona Mansour. It's a funny and sort of tragic story about a young Palestinian scholar who goes off to London with his new bride to deliver a career-defining lecture on the poetry of Wordsworth on the eve of the Six-Day War. So it's about the cultural tensions. It's about language, its power, and the pull of tradition and family and homeland, as opposed to the lure of modernity and career ambition.
So we're about halfway, I guess, through the festival now, and there's still quite a bit to come.
Well, we have, this three plays have opened so far. How We Got On also opened last weekend by Idris Goodwin, about hip-hop in the 80s in the suburbs. Coming up on Sunday is Courtney Barron's play, Eat Your Heart Out, is opening on Sunday. So, but there will be seven plays plus three 10-minute plays opening at the end. So, yeah, we're reaching that halfway point as far as main stage productions go.
Now, there's some other events that go on throughout the festival, panel discussions and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's a few different exciting weekends. This coming up this weekend, this Saturday, is a community panel on community engagement that's being presented in conjunction with the IDEA Festival organizers. There's lots of information on Actors Theater's website, actorstheater.org, about that.
All right, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us again today and the rest of our WFPL News team. Great job, as always. And we will see you back here next week.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, the latest from Frankfort with Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the Kentucky General Assembly continues in Frankfort, the long 60-day session. And covering for us and for Kentucky Public Radio is Kenny Colston. Kenny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is the long session during which a two-year budget, is always passed, and a budget bill is moving through the legislature, right?
That's right. The House made their changes in committee earlier this week and wasted no time at all passing four, if you can consider the tax amnesty bill. But all four of those bills passed them off the House floor with actually not a lot of, criticism or a lot of kind of rejection of that at all. I mean, in past years, you usually have some people who get up and yell about the budget and, funding this or not funding that or a lot about debt. And you didn't have a whole lot of that. I mean, you had a few. Representative Jim Wayne, obviously, is upset with the budget. But it now goes to the Senate. And I talked with the Senate Budget Chairman Bob Weaver this morning, and he says that the Senate's probably going to take a little bit of time to go over the budget. Look at the House proposals, look at what the governor originally proposed. They're even going to look at the budget that they passed 2 years ago to see how things match up. And they're going to take their time and probably make a few more changes. It's all but certain they're going to change some things. Just what those things are, we don't know yet.
And this inevitably will come down to what they call a conference committee, where the two opposing bills will be reconciled.
Right, that's right. And in the past, last couple of sessions, they've gone to that conference committee and they've thrown out different proposals, but it's really been a lot of staring at each other. House Speaker Greg Sabo kind of stares at David Williams. David Williams kind of stares back. And that's why we've had special sessions. But the feeling is that we're not going to have a special session this time. There's a couple different things that could happen, but there's really not a lot of money to play with. in the budget. I mean, the road fund will probably be a totally different story, but they usually work that out at the end of the day anyways, building roads and all that, and bridges. Of course, the Louisville Bridges Project is in the road plan, but there's the feeling that, no matter what the Senate changes, they'll be able to kind of work through those changes, and we won't have a special session like we've had the last couple of budget sessions.
So maybe a little bit of staring down, but not enough to spur a special session.
Yeah, maybe like 30 seconds. Someone yawns and says, "Hey, this proposal looks pretty good. Let's just sign our name."
Okay, well, let's move on to something else. There's some contentious moments yesterday over a bill. It seems like this comes up every session that would require drug testing for welfare recipients. That what happened there?
Yeah, that was kind of a little showdown between the House Republicans and House Democrats. Representative Lonnie Napier has this bill where he wants to have random drug testing of welfare recipients. It's that argument that a lot of people think that everybody on welfare is obviously using the money to buy drugs or some sort of that. And I don't think Napier necessarily thinks that, but there's a fraud argument that he's trying to make there. And House Democrats, well, at least a few of them, really are kind of repulsed by this argument. And it just so happens that all the ones that are repulsed by the argument happen to sit on the House Health and Welfare Committee, which this bill went through. Chairman Tom Burch has called Napier's bill unconstitutional. He's not a fan of it. And he didn't allow it come for a vote this session, and just like he did in last session. And the Republicans have said that, you know, with 64 co-sponsors, clearly this bill can pass out of committee and can pass on the full House floor, and you're not giving it a fair hearing. So what they did is, knowing that two Democrats were going to be absent from that committee due to other arrangements, they boycotted, which means that any bill that Burch wanted to hear a vote on, he couldn't do it, including the welfare, drug testing and welfare bill. So they had they still had the committee, and Napier went up and presented his bill and got a lot of blowback from a lot of Louisville area representatives, Representative Marzi and Representative Owens, who basically said, "You're being unfair, and, you know, you're attacking the poor. Let's drug test those on Wall Street." And Owens even said, "Let's drug test lawmakers." And oddly enough, Napier said, "I'm all for it. Let's just drug test whoever."
Yeah, I think that was a similar provision suggested in Indiana as well, when that bill's come up there. Also, moving on, there was a measure moving through that would try to eliminate or battle the so-called pill mills and the overprescription of painkillers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. House Speaker Greg Stumbo has kind of made this his chief priority, in addition to the U-Pike bill, which we've talked about many times and is being changed. But this bill basically would put the Casper pill tracking system from the Cabinet for Health and Family Services into the Attorney General's office. And Stumbo says that's the key piece of the legislation, and he's calling it landmark legislation. One of these bills that you'll talk about in education, you talk about Senate Bill 1, because that basically redid the CAPS testing system. And he equates this bill to the same type of, I guess, standing. And so the Attorney General, which is a law enforcement agency, would be in control of Casper. It would allow prosecutors and doctors and to look at Casper reports, and basically it would try to cut off the head of these people who go from doctor to doctor and get these pain pills. They say, you know, "Doctor, my back hurts." The doctor writes a prescription thinking nothing is odd about it, and they do this to four or five doctors, and you have a prescription pill problem. And so the idea is that doctors would communicate more, law enforcement would communicate more. It passed out of the House yesterday. There's a similar bill with some changes in the Senate. Notably, the Senate does not have the provision that Casper must go into the Attorney General's office. But at the end of the day, the Senate bill is now on its floor. At the end of the day, Stumbo has said, one way or another, we're going to pass something comprehensive. He's really into putting Casper in the Attorney General's office, and it's my feeling that the end of the bill will probably have that if it passes both chambers, whatever this compromise is. And maybe some of the other stuff like reporting and who reports and how many days until they can act on a doctor that is legal prescribing. That stuff can change. But at the end of the day, there's the feeling that this will be the big bill of the session.
And just a couple of minutes left. There was a big rally in Frankfort yesterday. Another issue that seems to come up every session, restoring voting rights for certain felons.
That's correct. There was a Kentuckians for the Commonwealth held a rally in the Rotunda for this. This is another proposal that the House seems to support, and it's a constitutional amendment to restore the voting rights for nonviolent felons, and that's the key. I mean, obviously, you don't want someone who's probably murdered four or five people to have full restoration of voting rights. At least that's what some people argue. But these are for people who get felonies that are nonviolent and who, you know, in effect have rehabbed their life and have served their time, is what the House members say. It's already passed out of the House like it does every year. It seems to be, once again, dead on arrival of the Senate. So the rally was basically to pull House Republicans who support the bill and other people who support the bill to show the Senate, hey, listen, this is not a straight Democrat versus Republican issue. We've got Republicans who support us. You know, these people have served their time. Please pass this so we can put it on the ballot. Whether that happens or not is probably doubtful. The Senate just really doesn't seem to have a stomach for the proposal.
Now, lawmakers meeting today, or are they watching the UK game that's underway as we speak?
Well, it depends on which ones you talk to. I mean, the House had 80 members who showed up, and the Senate took an hour to get its 20 that's required for a quorum. Of course, Senate President David Williams isn't there, and told one of the Courier-Journal reporters that he doesn't quite care, to put it nicely, whether or not that anybody wrote that he was there or not. So he's not there, and a few others aren't there. The governor's in New Orleans watching the game, and so it's probably going to be like that for better or worse until Kentucky and Louisville and Western and whoever else makes the tournament loses. These lawmakers are probably always going to have an eye and maybe their fannies in seats wherever these teams go.
All right. UK opening play in the Southeastern Conference tournament this Friday afternoon. Kenny Colston is the Capital Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is State of the News on WFPL. The Kentucky State Fair Board has been in the news recently since it was disclosed that Governor Steve Beshear has apparently been pushing for the ouster of Fair Board President Harold Workman. Joe Sokka of Leo Weekly has been writing about the Fair Board and its practices this week, and he joins us now. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start a little with a little informational stuff. Exactly what is the Fair Board? It does a lot more than just plan the state fair.
Yeah, the Fair Board operates the Expo Center and the International Convention Center downtown, and they also operate the KFC Yum Center. So they operate all three of those, and they're usually self-sufficient in terms of their operating expenses are all paid by the revenues that they take in. But they've fallen into serious budget issues, and in the last fiscal year, they were $6.5 million in the hole. And that's why in Steve Beshear's most recent budget proposal, he's proposing an $8.5 million bailout to prop up the Kentucky State Fair Board, with $5.5 million of that going to them immediately, and two subsequent years after that getting $1.5 million.
Now, there is a fair board, then there is a permanent president, who is Harold Workman, has been there for about 20 years. Apparently, the governor does not want him to continue past when his contract runs out this summer. But why is that? Is that because of the budget?
That's actually a mystery. Beshear is very vague about the reasons why he wants new leadership there. It came out 3 weeks ago that a member of the Fair Board's board of directors said that she had received a call from Ron Carmichael, the chairman, saying that Beshear had wanted Workman out. Now, Ron Carmichael has talked about needing a new direction and maybe a succession plan for once Workman leaves, and saying that they need more fiscal accountability so they're more in the loop on their finances. And at that meeting, they made a motion to hire a new CFO that would report directly to the board and not to Harold Workman.
Now, you have been looking into salaries and hiring practices in recent years at the board. What did you find?
Well, I found that administrative salaries have gone up fairly dramatically over the last few years. There was a reorganization of the Fair Board when the KFC Yum Center came around that they would operate. But I found that in many divisions, some that really have nothing to do with the arena per se, people were switched around to new position titles. They were still head of the division, but they were getting rather dramatic raises. Some people have received raises of over $20,000 a year, even though it's unclear just how much their job duties have actually increased.
Have you gotten any response? I know you reached out to the Fair Board employees and others. Have any response to your?
I haven't received the responses to most of my questions. I know that they were not happy with the story, but again, these are documents that we obtained through open records request over more than a month and hundreds of pages of documents to verify that these pay increases did in fact happen.
We've also learned recently that Harold Workman fired Ted Nicholson, the Yum Center manager, and that did not go over well with the Fair Board, who wanted to bring him back on. Now, U of L has hired Mr. Nicholson to oversee operations of when the NCAA tournament the games are played at the Yum.
Yes, this upset a great number of people with the NCAA tournament coming in, and it's still kind of a mystery what Workman's issue was with Nicholson. They've said that this is a personnel decision and that they don't have to speak out about why he was fired. But again, the tourism cabinet sent out a press release right before they announced that University of Louisville had hired Nicholson, and Jim Host and Carmichael and Steve Beshear really directly called out Workman for making an ill-informed decision. So as of right now, Workman's backed off and said that Nicholson will be allowed to do his job during the tournament, but it's not entirely clear whether he's actually going to be rehired once the tournament's over.
Now, Workman himself, he has his share of backers who say he's done a great job over the years.
Yeah. When this all came about, Senator Joey Pendleton was the biggest supporter of Harold Workman, saying praising all the great things he's done for the agricultural community and the Expo Center there in the state fair. And he actually proposed a bill which passed the Senate easily, which said that instead of Steve Beshear directly being able to appoint members to the Fair Board, their board of directors, they would have to be approved by the Senate first. So that has passed the Senate. Right now, it hasn't been sent to a committee in the House, but Pendleton is optimistic that it can pass there. And that's another interesting part of the story is the board chairman Ron Carmichael's term actually ends the same day that Workman's contract ends at the end of June. So he hasn't really directly threatened, but he said that he's very interested in seeing if Beshear appoints Carmichael again, since it's rather obvious that there's a disagreement on Workman's future there.
Right. And there has been some, I guess, positive economic news coming out of the Fair Board recently. The deal has been reached with the owners of Holiday World in Indiana to reopen the old Kentucky Kingdom Park.
Yeah. And that's one of the big reasons why the Fair Board has been in such financial trouble over the last few years, is Kentucky Kingdom has been vacant. The executive inn there, the big hotel that was next to the fairgrounds that was raised recently, their recent plans, they're trying to get someone to come in and build a $100 million luxury hotel so they can entice more conventions to come there. So it's kind of a large number of factors that have come in, including losing University of Louisville basketball games to the Yum Center, which used to come to Freedom Hall. So they're facing many different challenges right now in their budget.
Okay, we will see what happens as in the months ahead. Joe Sanka has been writing about the Fair Board in this week's issue of Leo Weekly. Joe, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to recall the events of the deadly tornadoes and the aftermath from last week and beyond, with two meteorologists from here in Louisville and two staff members from the News and Tribune in Southern Indiana. It's coming up next. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and we are a week removed now from the devastating tornadoes and storms that moved across the region. And here to talk about it are four people who were in the midst of it a week ago and beyond. Jay Cardozzi is the chief meteorologist at WLKY-TV. Monty Webb is chief meteorologist at WHAS Television. Both, of course, were on duty as the storms moved across the area a week ago. Also with us are two journalists who've been covering the storm's aftermath in southern Indiana, reporter Braden Lammers and photographer Chuck Branham. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for joining us. We also welcome your input, 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255, or toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. Well, let's start with what caused all this destructive weather activity. Monty, what was going on in the atmosphere to bring all this about?
Well, you know, we had all the right ingredients. We had been talking about the potential for just a significant tornado outbreak for a couple of days prior. And basically, we had a ton of low-level moisture, warm, unstable, moist air moving in from the Gulf of Mexico, a lot of wind shear in the lower levels of the atmosphere and all the way up aloft, too. So when you think of wind shear, just think of it as a twisting of the atmosphere. All the ingredients came together. We had a warm front punch through during the morning hours. We had some severe storms, and then that approaching cold front during the early afternoon and evening hours out to the west of us, and we had those individual giant supercell thunderstorms that just fired up in that really moist, unstable atmosphere. And unfortunately, it was all the ingredients coming together to give us that outbreak that we saw on Friday.
Jay, how far in advance did you know that this is really going to be a serious event?
You know what? As far as the wind energy that Monty talked about and the potential, if other ingredients came together, we knew about a week in advance. We saw this pattern developing, at least somewhere close to the Ohio Valley. So, you know, 5-7 days in advance, the meteorologists are kind of on the chat rooms and what have you, saying, you know what, next Friday looks very interesting. And that is secret coding, if you will, among the meteorologists,
right,
saying,
yeah,
it could get pretty nasty around here.
Yeah.
You know, probably a couple of days prior then, you could really see that moisture, as Monty talked about, the jet stream winds coming together at the same place at the same time. And as those storms blew up, they tapped those winds and brought them right down to the surface.
And there was really no way to overstate how dangerous this was. I watched you guys at work on Friday, and I mean, you really couldn't overstate how dangerous this was. Take cover.
Right. Well, you know, when the first warning was issued around 2:50 Friday afternoon, you know, we were tracking these storms, and we started seeing the signatures of what could be a tornado. At first, you're looking at the velocity and some of the other data coming in from the radar, and you're thinking, wow, this looks pretty good. And then around 3 o'clock, we started getting much stronger signatures that we rarely see here in Kentuckiana. And then around 3:15-ish, we started picking up something we call a debris ball on the radar, where you could actually see the debris, the radar reflecting off of the debris that this massive tornado was starting to produce. And as I was sitting there telling folks, you need to run to your storm shelter, not walk. I want you to run to your basement. If you don't have a basement, go into that interior room. And while I was saying that, I just felt my chest tightening up, my throat starting to quiver a little bit, because I knew as I was saying this, there were people who were most likely going to die. I have never had that feeling before in the 20 years of doing meteorology for broadcast, for TV, and for the Air Force. And it's a feeling that I really hope I never have to go through again, because it was, and we had to work through it. I know my staff and I, several times while this whole outbreak was occurring, we were just looking at each other and just kind of in disbelief that we were actually seeing this happening to our friends and neighbors to the north.
You really, Jay, have to detach yourself, you know, from
You do. That's exactly the right terminology, because you still have to work it. And you got to keep the people out ahead of it safe. And you got to tell them, you know, get to that basement immediately. I can remember several times we were telling people, get below ground if you can.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was the type of storm that we were dealing with, the type of storm that typically happens out in Oklahoma, Kansas. You see the videos, the pictures about. Those were the storms that happened here. A little story here. We were on the air, Jared Heil and myself, really covering this thing. And Jared is actually from Henryville. Mm. And we just brought him as a full-time meteorologist this year. And about 15 minutes prior to really seeing where that storm was tracking, he called his mom and dad and said, you guys got to get to the basement now. And then after hearing immediately that Henryville had been devastated, he actually walked out of the studio and just had to go regroup. It was touching. It was like, you know, it really hit home at that time.
Mm. Was his family safe?
Family was safe. The tornado hit about 100 yards just to the south of him. Mm. Yeah.
My goodness. Now, here in the Louisville metro area, we're relatively unscathed. Does the Ohio River play into this at all?
No.
People like to think so, but no, we just got lucky. 20 miles south If those storms were to track 20 miles south, they would have moved through Metro Louisville. And I just don't even like to think about the destruction that would have been caused.
And here's a scary thing about that. 60 miles west of here, when the storms were moving through Evansville and what have you, they are on a beeline right towards Louisville. I looked at everybody in the news department and said, get ready. I mean, Metro Louisville could get hit and hit hard. And for some reason, as it crossed over Du Bois County, it weakened just a touch. We call it cycled. And that pulled the storm north by 10 miles or so, and the rest was history. It moved just north of Louisville.
Wow, that was the only difference.
Yep.
Unbelievable. Braden and Chuck, let me talk to you. Let's start with you, Braden. Where did you go after everything passed through?
Well, right after everything happened, actually Chuck, myself, and another reporter, David Mann, got in the car and headed up towards Henryville because we heard that was where a lot of the damage had occurred, and we got there probably about 4:45.
Yes.
And we walked, Henryville's not very large, and we stopped, got out of the car, walked the town, and it was chaos at the time. People were walking up and down the streets, some looking for help, some were just kind of wandering around, not really sure what to do. And police and emergency crews were already on the scene, and they had started to try and organize, but for them, I think it was a bit chaotic, too, with how many people were there and how much devastation had been caused.
Mm-hmm. The image, Chuck, that's probably going to be burned in my mind forever from Henryville, and it was on all the TV coverage as well as that school bus pushed into the building. I don't know if it was a business there or was it a home.
It is a business.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, that was just unbelievable. Well, what were your impressions when you first got to Henryville?
Well, when I first started walking in, from the south side of Henryville, you couldn't see that much. You know, I saw some damage here and some damage there, but being familiar with that community, I could look ahead and see where things used to be and rubble. And what, you know, people don't realize, I don't think, is you can see hundreds of pictures and you can see hours of video, but until you actually walk around that site, you don't realize how wide a swath, how devastating. I was just sort of left in awe.
And this, Jay mentioned, is his co-worker. This is a tight-knit community. It's a metro area, but it's a tight-knit community, and a lot of people know one another. Was it difficult for you to kind of keep your journalist hat on and stay detached?
It was very difficult. Having lived there for 3 years of my life and going into that community quite a bit to cover sporting events and events at schools, it was hard. And I did look back on it, and even while I was there, I became a little bit shaken by what I was seeing and just the horrific nature of it.
You know, Braden, you went up there and talked to a lot of folks. I've always found it in these situations kind of difficult to go up to somebody that's lost their home and say, you know, how do you feel and that sort of thing. How do people react to you?
You know, it says something about the community and that everyone was very willing to talk and very approachable. One of the first families I came across, they sat right in front of Henryville High School. The home had been damaged, but they were still able to stay inside of it. The front window was completely gone, and they were standing out on the porch, kind of checking everything out. And I walked up to them and was able to interview them for a little bit. But I talked to a gentleman and his wife was just sitting there in the rocking chair. I don't know if she was in shock or if it was just, you know, there's not a whole lot else they can do at the moment, but the people of Henryville have been, along with the other folks in southern Indiana that have been affected out in Marysville, we've been out there, and yesterday I was out in the Daisy Hill area. They've all been very resilient, and you can see that sense of community that maybe only the rural places have, that really they tied together, they've gone and just taken this bad opportunity or bad thing that happened to them and are moving forward, just relying on one another.
And the help that has come through has just been amazing.
That is true. A lot of help. At one point they even had to stop taking clothes for folks because they had so many, but I know they have a lot of food, a lot of supplies coming in, and we have a whole list of places where you can go to donate or where they're asking, I think now they're asking more for money than anything, so they can help rebuild those communities.
This is State of the News on WFPL. We're talking about last week's tornadoes and the aftermath with Jay Cardozzi from WLKY, Monty Webb from WHAS-TV, and also Braden Lammers and Chuck Branham from the News and Tribune in Southern Indiana. Monty and Jay, I assume this, we of course don't want this to happen, but you get some valuable information out of an event like this.
Well, you do. I mean, it's for us here in the Kentuckiana area, the last time we saw an outbreak like this was back in 1974. Our tornadoes generally are not those long-lived plain states type of tornadoes. We have these quick spin-ups that will touch down, generally EF0s, EF2s, maybe an EF3, but they stay on the ground for, you know, 1, 2, maybe 3 minutes at the most, and they're generally very small and very narrow. This one was on the ground for 49 minutes, traveled 49 miles from Washington County, Indiana, all the way to Trimble County, Kentucky. It gave all the meteorologists here, not only for broadcast, for the television stations, but out at the National Weather Service office in Louisville, an opportunity to witness that type of storm, to track that type of storm, build a database, and it really will help us in the future forecasting and tracking these type of tornadoes, and hopefully it'll be another 30, 40 years before we see something like that again.
1974, you mentioned that's that awful outbreak of tornadoes. The technology has obviously really changed since then, and Jay has saved hundreds, thousands of lives.
Phenomenal. The technology from 74 to today is there is no comparison, actually. Back then, it was a black and white screen. You actually had to, we didn't have the NEXRAD technology to actually tell what the winds were doing, and we couldn't resolve the winds the way we can now. With the better radars that are coming online, I mean, we can pinpoint exactly where that tornado is at, how strong it is, how strong it may be on the radar scope to, you know, to warn those people out ahead. And one thing I can say is, yeah, we've learned a lot from this situation. Well, you know, we learned a lot from 74, from 2004, what have you. But the bottom line, what folks need to know is that it was somewhat rare that happened here, but it's going to happen again. If the conditions are right, and they will be right again in the future, it will happen again. So all we can do is prepare for that, and you know, hopefully the technology increases, and we can give people better warnings. Simple as that.
Right.
We have an email question from Bill. He says, we hardly ever hear about a tornado hitting a dense downtown metropolitan area. What would happen to office towers and the like if, say, for example, the Henryville Twister hit downtown Louisville?
Destroy them.
Yeah,
I mean, it really would. It would actually do a number on, you know, office towers, you know, homes in the area, you name it. You saw some of the steel structures in Henryville, and they were just twisted and mangled. Imagine that happening to one of the taller buildings here in town, and it would happen.
Yeah, it would probably blow out all the windows, damage some of the high rises pretty significantly. Homes in Louisville, whether it be West Louisville, the Highlands, into the East Louisville. I mean, it would destroy those homes, just like what we saw up in Henryville. It would happen the same thing here in Louisville, but in a much more densely populated area. So, you know, it's just, we were so lucky here in downtown that it did not move through on Friday.
Does this in any way foretell an especially severe spring storm season this year?
You know, I the bottom line was we are set up for a very active spring. I mean, it's been a warm winter. As Chuck mentioned, the Gulf did not cool down, so the warm, moist air is right there, and it's already moving northward. We've already seen tornado outbreaks in January around here. Again, Leap Day, and then a couple days later, the March right. outbreak. And, you know, I think for the next week to 10 days, it looks quiet around the area, as the pattern has certainly changed somewhat. But it seems that we're in about a 30-day cycle now of these active weather patterns. So I would expect probably as we get into, you know, early to mid-April, you'll see things heat up once again. So the chances are good that severe weather season is going to be quite active again around the area.
And Jay, I'm hoping that with La Nina starting to weaken and dissipate, that it may be our saving grace.
Hopefully.
I can hope, yes.
Hopefully.
Let's talk about La Nina. This is a cooling of the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
Right.
And How does that reach us?
Well, generally, like last spring, if you remember, it was a very active spring, not only here in the Ohio Valley, but across the Dixie Alley area, you know, down in Alabama and everything as well. And generally for us here in the Ohio Valley, when we have a strong La Nina, it tends to be a very active spring season. We saw that last year, and that's why I mentioned to Jay, I'm hoping that with La Nina weakening, it will take away some of the energy that and help us from becoming as active as we were last year. But as Jay mentioned, you know, the Gulf is still warm here. It was a very mild winter, so we'll just wait and hope that they kind of balance each other out.
And that's the difference from this year to last year. Last year we had a cold winter.
Right.
I mean, it was snowy and cold around here, as was the winter prior to that. So that real warm, moist air didn't make it as far north in time to capture some of that jet energy and get these storms really popping and turning around here, although it happened just south of us. Totally different story this go around.
And I have to ask, we always ask this question, is there any indication that any of this is related to climate change?
You know,
that is the $64,000 question.
Put you on the spot.
I knew this was going to come up too. I did.
It is public radio.
You know, yeah, climate change, it's happening. It's happened forever and ever and ever. It's going to continue to happen. Is it caused by global warming, by humans and what have you? Maybe. I can tell you this. I think it's a weather pattern we're in, as Monty mentioned. I think it's the La Nina combined with the weather pattern that was just dominating the entire northern hemisphere. I mean, we had one of the warmest winters, Rick, but halfway around the world, it was one of the coldest and snowiest of all time.
Right.
So
who knows?
Weather patterns.
Point, right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Jay Cardosi, Monty Webb, Braden Lammers, and Chuck Branham. Great work, heroic work at sometimes. We appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, in the hours and days following the storms, people wandered around their destroyed towns, some in a stupor. They cleared wood and bricks and downed trees from streets and homes. They gathered in churches and community centers to donate food and clothes and time to help those who had lost everything. These are some of their voices collected by WFPL reporters during the past week.
I videotaped the tornado and the hailstorm. I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was sitting there, standing there watching it, and it kept getting closer and closer and closer, and it made a right-hand turn tonight, and it saved my life.
He said, I was worried to death about you because the last time I talked to you was 20 till 3, and I asked you how long you were going to be there, and you said, you know, I told him I'd be here till 5:30 or till I got blew away. And
somebody on my bus told me that Marysville, like, is completely destroyed, and I had a panic. Like, I panicked and started crying.
My customers' cars are okay, probably. Some of my tools will be covered, but, you know, part of the building maybe, but I won't have enough to rebuild it, I don't think. We'll see.
Pretty depressing. Everybody's a little upset about what happened, but they are happy that no one in their family, you know, passed away and everything. We were real lucky here in Maryville that we didn't have more deaths than what we had, so.
We stayed through both hits. We had two hits. And there was about a 15-minute break between the hits. And then there was hail.
Some of them come down, I would say, there was not very many, but some of them come down as big as volleyballs, and when they hit, they splatted out, but the baseball size ones, they stayed intact. And the animals, I've seen deer that just look like they can't hardly walk, have been beat up so bad by it.
I was in the safest place I could be, and I knew where to be, so we were okay.
There's no question about it. The damage is heartbreaking, and it's something that you never really get used to. We often get the question, is this the worst you've ever seen? My opinion really doesn't count too much, but the opinion that does count is the people that have been affected. It may be the worst they've ever seen.
This town's never seen kind of destruction like this. This is by far the worst thing that's ever happened here.
He doesn't have words. I've talked to him about it, you know, and he basically said, Dad, he says, I can't hardly comprehend this. This is just almost too much. He says, Henryville's gone. I said, yeah, I said, you know, we've lived here 10 years.
It's just part of life is having to go through traumas like this. Maybe it makes you a stronger person after it's all over with. I don't know. It's hard.
there's no sense of where to go from here. There's no what do we do now type scenario, you know. the kids are talking about their spring breaks and stuff like that, but where are they going to go to school at? Where are they going to finish the year?
Henryville has forever changed. I mean, just coming up 160 into town, I mean, the trees that are usually there and the homes that are usually there are not only rubble, but are just gone. And you can see things that you shouldn't be able to see from the road. I mean, it's things that you never saw before.
Basically, we just need people out here to help get the community back to how it was and help all the families out here that have nothing left. And that's all we need.
What was it like to come out of the basement and just see this?
There goes your dreams. Just like waking up from a good dream.
Those were voices from southern Indiana and eastern Kentucky, recorded by reporters in the days following the tornadoes that roared through the region. There is an accompanying slideshow that's been put together by WFPL's Devin Katayaman. You can see it at our website, WFPL.org. That's all the time we have for today's program. For information on topics discussed today, visit our website, WFPL.org. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News team, which includes Gabe Bullard, Philip Bailey, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, Aaron Keene. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.